All right. This is Galen Joseph Hunter. You are listening to WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I am sitting here in the ACRA studio with Gary Hustwit. Hustwit, your choice. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Galen.
Welcome back to Wave Farm.
Thank you.
So last time you were here, I think, was on topic, right? You were doing some shooting?
Yeah. No, we did a little bit of filming out here in the forest for the Brian Eno movie that is currently in release. And it was supposed to be, I think we intended it to be kind of experimental, just to kind of see how it would feel to have some speakers out there in the trees. But it worked really well, and we just put it in as is, basically.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, it's a nice little scene. Like all the scenes in the Eno film, which is the film is generative, so it may come up when people see the movie, or they may have to watch it, you know, 10 or 15 times to see the Wave Farm scene. But
as one should see it 10 or 15 times. So part of the reason we're having this conversation is because there is a screening happening on Thursday, October 10th at Hudson Hall, correct?
Yep.
And this is a screening that, correct me if I'm wrong, you'll be mixing live?
Yeah, we'll be generating the film live in the room. So we'll bring our Brain One, which is it's both our generative software platform, but it's also what we call the hardware device. It's like a generative film machine that we designed with Teenage Engineering. It's a Swedish synthesizer lunatics. So with that machine, we'll basically make the film in real time. And that version will never be seen again, because every version of the film is unique. It's different every time it shows.
Amazing. And I'm getting like way ahead of myself here, so I'm going to reel us back. Okay. And I want to start by asking you about your work. You are the director of this film. What's your background? Tell us about your work a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I've been making films now, either producing or directing, for a little over 20 years. Prior to that, I was involved in lots of other independent media things, book publishing. And then I worked with bands and at record labels, in the kind of late 80s and through the 90s. I kind of got into film because I sort of got obsessed with DVDs when I moved to New York in 98. DVDs had just come out and they were the hot new, you know, thing. And it wasn't like I was some cinephile before that, but for whatever reason, DVDs kind of caught me. And I started trying to, you know, look for more. And there weren't that many. There were just like major studio stuff. And there were like no real independent films. Like Criterion had just kind of started releasing DVDs. So I kept thinking, just from my independent record label background, I kept thinking, you know, somebody's going to start like an independent record label, but for DVDs, just putting out like indie music things and cult films and just cool stuff. And after obsessing about that for like 6 months, I finally just quit my job and started a DVD label. I didn't really know anything about
Amazing.
What that meant. But I managed to convince the director of DVD production at Criterion to leave and join me in doing this startup. So through that, I got involved in so many different films that were in various stages of completion. A lot of times, well, the very first project that came in was the Wilco documentary, I'm Trying to Break Your Heart, which at that point, they had started it, but then the story of the band, like the record label, like dropping them and everything that was happening. Was that us?
It was not us. We are an open scenes radio station here, and there is someone downstairs preparing for a performance.
All good. Just now I know.
We may hear them again, I'm guessing.
Yeah. But through this process of releasing films in theaters and on DVD, I got to see the how documentaries were made. And, you know, after doing that, you know, producing five or six films. I produced a film about Robert Moog called Moog that was on Showtime and released. Did a ton of other really interesting things. And eventually I was kind of like, well, this making a DVD isn't really that, doesn't seem that hard. It's, or sorry, back up.
Making a film.
Yeah, making a documentary doesn't seem that hard. It's just kind of like project managing. You're kind of putting together a group of really talented people and you have an idea and kind of just, you know, managing it through the different phases. And I'd always been really interested in graphic design and fonts. And I was kind of wondering why there wasn't a movie about graphic design and typography. This is in 2005. And I also just obsessed about that for a while and just couldn't believe that it didn't already exist. And then I decided to make Helvetica, which was the first film I directed. And it did really, really well. There were a lot of other people, I guess, that were also font geeks, like dying to watch a movie about the people who make typefaces and use them and sort of their impact on our lives and visual communication.
I recommend that documentary to someone at least every other month.
Yeah. And then it kind of hit me that, oh, I could just make films about things that I'm interested in, and there are probably other people out there who are interested in them too. And then I just have since then have made multiple films about other areas of design or architecture or cities or and now music. Again, my background was music. I never really directed a music documentary, and in 2018 I released a film about Dieter Rams, who's a German designer. It's called Rams. And just on a lark, a friend asked me, like, well, who would you want to do the soundtrack for this thing? And I'm like, I don't know, how about Brian Eno? That would be amazing, because I don't know, somehow it feels like his music and Ram's design aesthetic would match. And this friend, that was Sam Valenti, who does the Ghostly record label, and he said, oh, well, God, I just met Eno's manager a few weeks ago. Ram, do you want his contact? And I'm like, oh, okay, what the hell? And just sort of cold emailed, and turned out that Brian was also a fan of Dieter Rams and had was aware of my films and said yes. So we started working on the soundtrack for Rams. That's around the same time that I was like, well, Jeff, why isn't there like a epic career-spanning documentary about you, Brian? And then he basically told me that he just hates music documentaries and hates bio documentaries because they're so subjective. It's always one person's version of this other person's story. Mm-hmm. And basically like said no and turned me down. And several years later, I just started getting these ideas about a generative film or just this question of why do films have to be the same every time we watch them? Just seems like such a kind of like an outdated constraint, mm-hmm. Seeing that everything is digital now. So I started working with a programmer and digital artist named Brendan Dawes, who's in England. We started playing around with this idea of like what could a generative film be? What would the software platform look like? And we did some experiments early on with the material from my previous film, Rams, and Brian's music, and then showed those to Brian in 2019, and he kind of was blown away, and then he wanted to agree to get involved.
If there's an artist to start making generative film about, then it is Brian Eno.
Yeah, no, it totally made so much sense, yeah. And it was the reason that he did the project. He didn't want to make a film about himself, right. But he wanted to be involved in this generative film experiment. So
we've been, as I mentioned to you when we were walking into the studio, generative has been sort of the theme of the week here, or probably the theme of the year. And I feel like maybe there's some listeners that don't actually know what one means when you talk about generative music or generative film. You want to expand on that a bit, or
yeah? Well, like I see it as you're creating the thing that makes the thing. You're not creating a film or a piece of music. You're creating a system in which that piece of music or that film can make itself. So you're like growing the artwork instead of kind of consciously making every piece of the art.
And the output from that system is constantly evolving and changing too, would you say? Or no, not necessarily.
Well, it is in the sense that every time it runs, it's different. The output is different.
Right.
And you know, I still wanted the movie to feel like a cinematic documentary. It's not like a video art piece or an experimental mashup of clips. I wanted it to have structure and have a narrative arc and a progression. And so that was a lot of the programming, was making something that could change every time, but still have that sense of coherence and a progression.
Right. I was thinking about this in preparation for speaking with you today, like about whether or not the liveness is really critical. Like if one listens to a recording of something generative or watches a recording of something generative, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think the liveness is not necessarily critical in this case, because really if you're looking at the screen, the output is the same if I had rendered a file out and we would have just played the file, or if we're making it in real time. There is something about being in a room and seeing something that only exists in that room. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think makes the film, but just the experience of watching it, more special than just watching a movie that you know is going to be exactly the same in every single cinema that it's in, or streaming, or anything like that. So there is a performative aspect right. to it, which is kind of what I was going for, because I think I was just getting really frustrated with the constraints of cinema, having to be mm-hmm. static and linear and, you know, always the same, and just wanted to do so. I wanted to be surprised by the film or what it could do. You know, you can never watch something with fresh eyes, especially if you've worked on it for years. Mm-hmm. But I wanted at least some form of that, to be able to watch it along with the audience kind of for the first time and the only time.
That's great. The film has really had an incredible run so far, right? I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it premiered at Sundance in January of this year, which was incredible and also just terrifying. Like really, literally just in the weeks up until Sundance, that's when everything sort of came together and started to work.
Wow.
But even a few weeks prior to that, there was still either software bugs, or we were still trying to figure out in terms of the footage, how to format or what to edit. So everything kind of came together, but the process is cool because it continues to evolve. When the version we showed at Sundance was generation one of the film platform and then content, and now we're up to generation four. So we've continued to change the software, add new functionality, add hours and hours and hours of new material and footage and music into the data set. So the film grows as we've, you know, over the past 9 months as we've been showing it. But we've been showing it all around the world, and I mean, hundreds of times now. And then it was at Film Forum in Manhattan for 12 weeks, a 12-week run, which was incredible. Phenomenal, with a different version of the film every day. So there were people coming back 2, 3, 10, I think the record was 18 times.
Wow.
Somebody came in back and saw it 18 times. But it's kind of, it's almost like when you, in terms of the film and Brian, it's kind of works like if you meet someone for the first time and you know, you talk with them for an hour and you get some level of information from them. You kind of put together a story of mm-hmm. what they're about and what they're doing, et cetera. And then you come back maybe few weeks later and you spend another hour with them, now you get kind of a deeper level of information and story, and you kind of add to it. I feel like that's how the film works on repeated views. There are definitely things that are that carry on from previous versions of the film, but you're always going to see something new, and you're just kind of building this composite portrait of someone. When it comes down to it, the whole construct of like a 90-minute documentary about someone's life, it's crazy. It's just ridiculous. You could never fit anyone's life story into right. anything remotely. They're a 6-hour series or whatever. You're always leaving things out. So I think part of this approach was trying to have all that stuff is in there. It might not come up every single time, but you've got we had Brian's archive was 500 hours of footage plus all the footage that we shot with him over 3 years. So there's a lot of stuff in there, and you're not going to see the David Byrne scene every time. You might have to watch it 6 times to see the David Byrne scene, but it's in there, and it could come up.
For someone who is not familiar with Brian Eno, but maybe just heard the name or something, will they get an introduction for sure, knowing what,
definitely like his biographical kind of like highlights are in there, Bowie and working with in Roxy Music, and then ambient music and all his sort of like sound and video and visual art experiments are all in there. I think the thing that I kept coming back to was creativity and the creative process and Brian's creative process and how he enables creativity in himself and in others, like in the studio situation. That's the stuff that I'm fascinated by. The music is amazing. It's great. Everything's the biographical stuff is all good, but I really wanted to center the film on creativity, and, mm-hmm. and that's what I kind of keep coming back to. So almost every scene in the film, there is some creative takeaway. So if you're at all, and it, you don't have to be a musician or an artist or anything, I think everyone gets something out of it, because he's someone who can speak very coherently and succinctly about why we make art and why we like music and what these things do for us and why we do them. And that feels like a universal to me.
Nice. I realize, like, for our listeners, we just have kind of been talking with the assumption that they do know who Brian Eno is. So maybe, like, as we conclude this conversation, and through this idea of like the lens of creativity, how
we can just chop this up and we'll play some, you know, some Bowie. We'll play Heroes, and yeah, and we'll just mix some music in here too, and we'll get a better idea.
What would you share with someone who says, "Who is Brian Eno?"
In terms of things to listen to?
Well, no, I'll ask you that in a minute, because I want you to choose our outgoing music for this. But if you met somebody at a party or on the street and you said you did this film and they say, "Who's Brian Eno?"
Yeah, when I go through the description of who Brian Eno is and like what he does and who's worked with, usually people are like, they usually say, "Oh, you mean like Rick Rubin?" And I'm like, no. It's the other way around. Like, Rick Rubin doesn't exist without Brian Eno. Right. Rick Rubin's trying to be Brian Eno. But yeah, you know, everyone knows Brian Eno's work.
Whether they know it or not.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Everyone, I think, in the Western world at least, knows like Heroes by David Bowie, or Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime, or U2, you know, any of those records that Brian's, you know, fingerprints are all over, or that he co-wrote or produced. So they've heard Brian Eno before. And even just saying, could you play some ambient music to anyone? Like the term ambient music did not exist before mm-hmm. Brian's early, those ambient records. People were doing that stuff, but since he kind of coined the term and released several records under that moniker, it you know, he's identified with like creating ambient music,
right.
Which he will also deny, but things get identified to him. And I just think he's just a really interesting creative thinker who hasn't, part of the I think my goal or what I get to do in making a documentary, you have people who have these amazing careers and they're great speakers and they do lectures and they do all this kind of stuff. It's hard to grasp the breadth of that, or to kind of condense it in a way that is easy for people to kind of understand. And not that this generative approach does that necessarily. I mean, it does it in the sense that the film's around 85 minutes every time, and you're going to learn something about this person. But I think that Eno is one of those people. He's done so much in the past 50 plus years, and he can get very kind of dense intellectually. Very, you know, he's you know, talking on a very high level about some of these ideas. So it's trying to crystallize that in a way that's cinematic and that's engaging and that you feel inspired by. But that's also understandable.
Thank you for that.
I don't think I really, did I really actually describe who Brian Eno is?
I think you did. You did a great job. The reason that I'm sitting here talking with Gary Hustwit is because his film Eno will be screening at Hudson Hall on Thursday, October 10th. If people are interested, hudsonhall.org for more information, including info about tickets. Is there a specific Eno site or a site that for your work that you'd direct people to if they
sure.
want to find out more?
Well, hustwit.com, which is just my last name.com, or enofilm.com.
Excellent. This has been super fun, and I can't wait to see the film, which I haven't seen yet, actually. I will see it on Thursday.
You will see a version
of it. A version, right. To see a version of the film. I do want to ask you to choose what our outgoing music will be.
Oh, this I needed warning on this. Oh, gosh, what would be a good... well, I mean, there's definitely things from the soundtrack album, because there's a soundtrack record that was released that has 17 tracks that are really just a real nice overview. Or, I mean, you can't put Brian Eno's career into 17 tracks, especially with the collaborations and stuff too. But everything from the all the songs that we used, you know, dozens and dozens of songs in the film. We showed those all to Brian, and he chose 17 that he wanted to have on the release. There's a great the Cluster and Eno record, I think, is amazing. There's a track, I think, the Bell Dog, I think, is on the soundtrack. That's a good one to go out with.
All right.
I'm trying to think of in the we'll just give you some options. In the Wave Farm scene, I think we're hearing Music for Airports. 3 or 2-1 is the track. So you could also play that. That would be very on brand.
Which track is it again?
I think it's 2-1. 2-1/1.
All right. We'll go out with Music for Airports 2/1. thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Gillian. It was great. Thanks.